And verses 24 through to 27. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get the crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like someone running aimlessly. I do not fight like the boxer beating the air. No, I strike a blow to my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. There's a little bit of echo.
So Richard's going to come and tell us what this is. Here we are.
In due course, and I might have to get you to come up and hold it for me when the time comes, if that's all right, so that the people at home can see what it is that we're talking about. The monstrosity. No, it's not a monstrosity, but it's not a graven image, let me assure you. Now, where are we? I was in a village in the jungles of Argentina. Hang on. No, sorry. Wrong one. Sorry.
Danish.
When Alan asked me to preach on these four verses, I thought, oh, great, four verses. I've got to preach on four verses. And then I thought about it and thought about it and wrote down my thoughts. And when I had nine pages, I thought that would be enough. And I thought, well, that's too much. So I've chopped out three pages and printed the other six, sort of two sides. So it's down to three pages. When I told my son that I was speaking on these verses from Corinthians, he said, Rocky, you know what I'm talking about, don't you? Yeah. So this image of Sylvester Stallone running along, urged on by his coach, punching the air. You've seen it, haven't you? Is that good? That good? I'm going to win. Then I said, no, well, with the age group we've got, we should be thinking more Marlon Brando. But it could have been the champion. You all seen that one? Yeah, well, I did. So it's a wonderful cartoon in words, isn't it? What an image that Paul conjures up in these verses. And indeed, if we are going to be successful athletes or competitors, we do need to train and practice. And you probably won't believe this looking at me now, but I was once quite a decent athletes, and I used to run middle distance and cross countries and won a few trophies. But in order to be a successful athlete, you've got to run laps and run laps and run laps and run laps and then run more laps. And I got bored. I can't understand how the Olympic swimmers just swim up and down the pool for 3 hours in the morning and another 3 hours in the evening for years on end. So I got bored, but I have to say that the City du Surf started in 1971, I ran it in 59 minutes, which is under an hour is sort of elite. And De Castella ran it in 45, so I was only 14 minutes behind him. But then I got bored with running laps, so I got into cricket, and cricket was really my game. But if you're going to win a cricket match, what have you got to do? You've got to get in the nets and bat and bowl, and you've got to get out there and practice your fielding and catching and running people out. And if you don't do that, you don't win anything. Practice is so important. And so this image of the athlete training to win the prize. But what is the prize? Paul describes it as an imperishable wreath in the NIV, given as a crown, but not a crown. A crown as we would understand a crown. Would be a diadem in the Greek. So this is a wreath, and the the champion of the athletics got a wreath which was made of twigs and leaves and sort of round the head, and it hanging up on his wall with his other trophies, and it would rot. But the wreath that Paul is offering us is an imperishable wreath that will never rot. What, in fact, that amounts to is not really explained beyond that. And the commentators I've read have been reluctant to talk about what, in fact, the wreath is, the imperishable wreath. But it's sort of intuitive, isn't it? That it's the signal, the symbol of victory. Importantly, of course, Paul makes the point, there's not, in this case, just one winner. We all have the potential to be winners. So my sort of thoughts, what's this imperishable wreath? Well, it's really life in all its fullness, isn't it? It's life with Jesus. It's the fruits and gifts of the Holy Spirit. It's growth in sanctification, which we'll talk about later. And there's a wonderful image in Revelation with the rider on the white horse. You're familiar with that? The rider on the white horse has blood-spattered robe, and then we sit behind him as his army in pure white robes, because he has bled for us, he has died for us on the cross, and we're able to be part of that army in white robes. That's the way I see the imperishable wreath. So the next question is, how does Paul train? Well, Paul says, I punish my body and enslave it, so that after proclaiming to others, I myself should not be disqualified. That's curious. I'll explain why in a minute. But what, indeed, he's saying preachers are not immune, and we all know that, don't we? How many preachers do we know who have fallen by the wayside because they've failed to serve as they should? I had a close friend who was actually a bishop who unfortunately met a lady in the congregation and went off with her and left his family and is now a barrister. But it was very sad. Very sad for me, and obviously much sadder for his family. Preachers are not immune. Leon Morris talks about the strenuous self-denial of the athlete in training for his fleeting reward is a rebuke to all half-hearted, flabby Christian service. Notice that the athlete denies himself many lawful pleasures. The Christian must avoid not only definite sin, but anything that hinders his complete effectiveness, such as for clergy, of course, one-on-one with a member of the opposite sex in a counselling situation is potential disaster. But, you know, as I say, there are sins of commission and there are sins of omission. There is doing what we ought not to. There is also failing to do the things that we should do. And we'll talk about that later. Matthew Henry says, holy fear of ourselves and not presumptuous confidence is the best security against apostasy from God and final rejection by him. What he means by that is we should be afraid of our potential to stray or fall. Now, to me, there's a big elephant in the room. Are you hearing a contradiction here or a potential contradiction? What is Paul saying? Paul saying we've got to train for the prize. Now, Paul, as we know, was a good Reformed evangelical. No, didn't get a laugh at 8 o'clock either. No. Anyway, we're all good Reformed evangelicals. So we hold as truth that we are saved by grace alone, by the blood of Christ alone, not by works, Paul says, lest anyone should boast. But isn't he boasting here? Isn't he saying what he does to achieve the prize? Is he saying there's something extra that we have to do to win the imperishable wreath beyond simply relying on the blood of Jesus on the cross and salvation by grace? And he's saying if he doesn't do these things, he will lose his reward. Is there not an apparent contradiction between the idea of being saved by grace, not by works, I said anyone should boast, and he's only being saved by works? Is there a contradiction here? Well, I think if I could go back to the sporting picture, We need to move the game forward. So in football terms, we need to get it out of the backs, send it up to the strikers so they can score the goal. Or in rugby terms, and apparently Australia beat South Africa last night, those who are not aware. Yeah. And in rugby terms, they say, well, get it out of the pigs and spin it out of the wingers so they can score the try. If you don't understand that, I'll explain it later. In rugby league, of course, there are no backs and forwards. They're all the same size, which is huge, and they're all just as fast, so that all disappears. But anyway, let's not talk about any more about that. So we've got to move forward. Why is Paul saying we've got to do this stuff to gain this imperishable wreath? Can we save ourselves by our strenuous efforts, as Paul seems to be saying here? And a few other verses that would support that. It's right through the New Testament and the Old Testament. Romans 10:8, if you confess with your lips that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. Revelation, I am the one who searches hearts and minds, and I will give to each of you as your works deserve. James, blessed is anyone who endures temptation. Such a one has stood the test and will receive the crown of life. To the church in Laodicea, I know your works. Do you know what it is? You are neither cold nor hot. I will spit you out of my mouth. To the church in Sardis, I know your deeds. You have a reputation of being alive, but you are dead. Jesus himself, you know about who knows about the sheep and the goats in Matthew. You all familiar with that? Jesus? No? Yes? Jesus, talking about the final judgment, says this, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. Before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right, come you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. And the righteous will answer him saying, when did we do that? When did we do all that stuff? And Jesus says, truly, I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me. And then he will say to those on his left, the goats, get out of here, because you didn't do those things. And as you didn't do it for the least of these, my brothers, you didn't do it for me, and I'm not interested, you can get out. Now, if that's not a statement of being saved by works, what is? So there's an apparent contradiction. How do we resolve that? It's not easy, and I've been grappling with this apparent contradiction for 30 years. If you remember, you've heard of John Wesley, you remember Augustus Toplady. In the day, 250 years ago, they were the two great sort of leaders of the Anglican Church. Toplady wrote Rock of Ages, the hymn Rock of Ages. He was the Calvinist, Wesley was whatever the other thing was, and they were at loggerheads for throughout their lives over this particular issue of salvation by works or not. So how do we resolve this apparent contradiction? Well, some clues. Number one is the rule of common sense. I haven't seen anything in Scripture that says you can't use common sense when you read it. And common sense tells us that it is ridiculous to think that God's not interested in how we behave. He's just going to save us so that we can do whatever we like. It's ridiculous to suggest that God is not concerned about our well-being. It's ridiculous to suggest that God is not concerned about his reputation. And I've got a great article by J.O. Packer about God's, what he calls God's jealousy for his reputation. And we'll come back to that in a minute. Second clue is, well, as Alan said at the beginning of this series on Corinthians, we're not described as those who are saved, but those who are being saved. Salvation is not a moment, but a process. The verb is quite specific. Third clue is in Deuteronomy. We've been doing Deuteronomy 4. We started in January and we're still doing it, the book of Deuteronomy. I think they're getting a bit sick of it. I'll have to move on. But Deuteronomy 4. Got Moses, God speaking through Moses, I will be your God and you will be my people. This is paraphrasing. I give you these rules, Ten Commandments, and all the elaborations on the Ten Commandments, which constitute the book of Deuteronomy. I give you these rules for reasons. The reasons are, one, so that you will be a cohesive, happy, healthy, and prosperous community. You're my people. I am your God. You belong to me. I want you to be that sort of community. But then he looks at the fact that other nations, the nations around them, look at God's people. And he wants them to look at God's people and say this, surely this nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has a God so great, that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us whenever we call on him? And what great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as this law that I set before you today? So the law was given to a people who had been saved from slavery so they could be a cohesive community and they could be seen by the people around them to be functionally God's people obeying God's laws and to be admired for it. Now, we've been rescued, just as they were rescued from slavery in Egypt, we've been rescued from the consequences of our own sin and rebellion by Jesus' blood on the cross. God expects our behaviour to be such that the community, the people around us who don't know God, will see God in us and will be drawn to him. That's what the Bible says. And that's what we haven't done very well for the last few decades. Now, the next clue brings us to, now I'll get my lovely assistant to come and hold this up so that, and David will tell us when it's on camera so that the people at home can see, and be very careful because I'm not a great engineer. Here we are. Can we see that, David? Right. So the people at home can see this structure.
They won't see it anywhere else.
The gospel according to Lego. Oh, sorry, Duplo. Duplo, let's not misrepresent it. So the Bible, throughout the New Testament, we have the words justified and sanctified. People often think they mean the same thing, but they don't. They're vastly different. And they have the same relationship to each other as words as wedding and marriage, which do not mean the same thing. So wedding is an event where people are formally come together and form a union. A marriage is what happens for the next 50 years. And I always used to say when people asked me to marry them, it's a long time now, but I used to say what matters is not the wedding, but the marriage. And as you know, the wedding, great, wonderful day, and you are one. But then over the consequent years, decades, for some of us, 50 or more, there is a process, isn't there, of sharing together, of learning from one another, of negotiating, of raising children together for many of us. There are also times of conflict and times of difficulty. There are times of forgiving one another. Judy's done a lot of that over the last 54 years. But the sum total of all of that is growth together. And if you can't, after 50 years of marriage, say you are more married now than you were at your wedding, what have you been doing? You know what I mean? Now, it's the same with justification and sanctification. And the yellow represents justification. The red represents the cross. Now, you've got that, haven't you? You're right. The yellow represents justification. So that's what happens when Jesus dies for you on the cross. It takes away the penalty that you should and do deserve because of your rebellion and sin against God. He takes that away, gives you a new life. You are a new person. You are justified, that's done and dusted. But following that is a process which the Bible calls sanctification, which is a process of growing together, of renewal, of negotiation, of forgiveness, all of those things that really bring the marriage together, so that at the end we're a different person than we were at the time that we were initially justified. So sanctification is a process of growth. And that's what Paul's talking about here. Thank you to my lovely assistant. And it didn't break. I'm bringing it up, it smashed into pieces, but I'm not a great construction engineer. So that gives you the idea, doesn't it? This is what Paul's talking about. So in a sense, we are judged by God. That's what Revelation tells us. Revelation says we are judged according to what we have done. That doesn't mean we're saved by works. It means that what we have done is the evidence that we are saved by our works. And Matthew Henry, talking about Revelation, says he will try their principles by their practices. Now, the epistle of James, which Luther wrote off as an epistle full of straw, because he didn't like it, because he thought James was talking about salvation by works. But I think when you read it carefully, it actually gives the best explanation of this dilemma that we've been talking about. Now, Luther was responding to the excesses of the Catholic priests who were selling, selling indulgences. They're saying, if you put money into the coffers, we'll give you salvation. Or if you that we have a bit of Saint whoever's little finger, but pay us big money for it, then you guaranteed a place in heaven, and so on and so on. So their own advantage. And Luther was reacting to that when he said, not by works, lest any man should boast. In the same way as Paul, in his day, was correcting the errors of the Pharisees, who had taken that law of Moses, given by God for a people who had been saved, to describe the way that their community should be operate. And the Pharisees had turned the law into the thing that was the means of salvation, instead of being the mechanism by which the saved people should live. And they were using it as a tool to their own advantage to suppress the people. And that was what Paul was reacting against. So I think James, unlike Luther, James does provide some answers to the dilemma that we've been talking about. He says, what good is it, my brothers and sisters, if you say you have faith but do not have works? Can faith save you? If a brother or sister is naked and lacks daily food, and one of them says, go and be well, but does not supply their bodily needs, what's the good of that? So faith by itself, if it has no works, is dead. I, by my works, will show you my faith. And later he says the famous verse, be doers of the word and not merely hearers who deceive themselves. So we are saved by the blood of the Lamb on the cross. There is no other way to be saved, not by works, lest any man should boast. We are saved in order to do the things that God has for us to do and to take steps to avoid falling to sin in order to win the imperishable wreath of victory. And Paul trains hard and disciplines himself not to sin, not to get into a position where he may sin, to do the good works that he's called by God to do, and, can I say, to trust and obey, for there's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey. You've heard that before. So in the same way, like Paul, we have things that we're given to do. Ephesians 3, I think, says, I've prepared you for a path of good works, because you are my people, because I am your God. We must do the good works that we've been given to do, and we must strive to avoid sinful behavior, not in order to be saved, but because we are saved. And then we'll be qualified to claim the imperishable wreath of victory. I'd like to finish by, if you'd like to join me, in a sort of a prayer, sung prayer. So you don't have to stand up, but we can do it sitting down, can't we? Up to you. Breathe on me, breath of God. And we'll do it a cappella. Is that right? A cappella. So yeah, you good for that? It's a tune everybody knows. And Judy will give you a note. Breathe on me, breath of God. Fill me with life anew, that I might love what thou dost love and do what thou wouldst do. Breathe on me, breath of God, until my heart is pure, until with thee I will one will to do and to endure. Breathe on me, breath of God, till I am wholly thine, until this earthly path of me flows with thy fire divine. Breathe on me, breath of God, so shall I never die, but live with thee the perfect life of thine eternity.
Well, thank you very much, Richard.